You catch up.
There's three of us.
Call Education Committee. Sorry, Paul. Solis Education together. It's February 25th. Representative Reinbold is excused today. Call the roll, if you would, please.
Representative
Here.
Representative Vasquez.
Here.
He'll be a few minutes late.
Here.
Here.
Here. Okay, today we have the funding formula overview, and I've been informed by the department that you might want to grab another cup of coffee. Actually, I make light of it, and I don't mean to. I actually look forward to the presentation, even though I've seen it before, because I learn something every time, and it's complex enough that you it's a while to soak in. So if you would come forward, identify yourself for the record, and on this one, typically what I do have been doing this year, and it's been working pretty good, is just kind of holding back on the questions. I won't do that today unless you want me to, the reason being that it's big enough that it's the big picture is less important on this one, and we may get into the weeds, but I'll try to proceed in a way that we can get through anyway, so I may ask to restrain some of our questions, but if you would, go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, Elizabeth Noodleman, Director of School Finance and Facilities for the Department of Education. And as the chair introduced, what we're going to look at today is the Alaska Public School Funding Formula Overview. And you do have a second handout in addition to the PowerPoint slides, and that is labeled Public School Funding Program Overview. In a, you'll find with that on pages 8 and 9, there is a spreadsheet that lays out visually in columns the presentation that we're going to go through today in the PowerPoint. So if you want to look to that at any time or look at that afterwards, the same calculation that we're going to make through these slides today is laid out for you on pages 8 and 9 of the other handout. So I wanted to make sure to bring that with me and point that out to you. As Chair Keller said, there are many numbers in this overview. And if we miss one of those numbers, we can go back. But what's important is to remember that what your funding formula does is it calculates funding for each district. And then it looks to see how that funding will be paid for or funded, so to speak. There are two definitions that I like to keep in mind before I head into the presentation. And one is average daily membership, ADM, and that's your October count. The second definition is adjusted average daily membership, AADM. And that is your increased count after going through the formula. So we will start with ADM. We will calculate AADM. We will come up with the funding for each district. And then we will look to see how that funding is provided for. And with that, we'll proceed.
Before you proceed, I want to acknowledge that Representative Reinbold has joined us, even though she was excused. And the budget subcommittee is going on. And as long as I've interrupted, I just want to repeat something that took me a little while to catch on to, and I just get your feedback on it. But you said that this is a formula on how the districts are funded, and that's there's not much information as far as how the money actually gets spent. In other words, when we take the different adjustments and we change the funding, that is hard to trace that directly down to the actual any program or any particular program is probably covers it. Am I right?
Correct, Chair Keller.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So So the current state public school funding formula was adopted under SB 36 in 1998 and implemented in 1999. You'll find this formula in law under Alaska Statute 1417. Again, as an overview, the calculation begins by calculating the adjusted average daily membership, calculation of basic need, also referred to as entitlement, looking at the components of funding basic need, who pays, looking at additional funds above basic need, such as additional local contribution, and then adding the Quality Schools grant to come up with the total funding. The average daily membership is the number of enrolled students during the 20 school day count period ending on the fourth Friday of October. Those students are counted in the school that they attend, in the district that they attend. Those reports are due to the department after the end of the 20 day school count, and along with that, in October, after the count is turned in, districts also turn in a projected count for the following year for budgeting reasons. Who's eligible for state foundation funding? A child who is 6 years of age before September 1 and under the age of 20 and has not completed the 12th grade. A child who is 5 years of age may enter kindergarten. A child with a disability and an active individualized education program may attend school if at the age of 3 or if under the age of 22. So those students on an IEP that fit that eligibility criteria are funded through the foundation formula. Again, the six steps to calculate entitlement is to adjust the average daily membership for school size, and we'll go through each of these separately, to apply the district cost factor, to apply the special needs factor, apply the vocational and technical factor, add intensive services counts, and add correspondence student counts to get to the district adjusted ADM. So the first item on our list was to adjust the ADM for the school size. The first thing we find here is at Alaska Statute 1417905 that defines schools. And an ADM in a school that is under 10, that ADM is added to the smallest school with an ADM greater than 10. The second size chart we have is an ADM of 10 through 100. And the grades K-12 are combined and adjusted once and funded as one school. A community with an ADM of 101 through 425, the formula aggregates K-6 and 712 and adjusts those separately. So the funding is distributed as if there were two schools at that size. And finally, a community with an ADM greater than 425, each facility administered separately as one school is adjusted.
Mr. Chairman.
And again, just so the committee is, because I am changing a little bit, I'm allowing interruption. Is that okay, Elizabeth?
Yes, Chair.
Okay, and we'll do that as we go this time. Representative Seaton?
I was just wanting an additional explanation on that last one. Each facility administered separately as one school. So would you give me an example of a large?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, an example of that would be whereas Juneau School District once had one high school, and now there are two high schools. Those two schools are administered separately. They're separate entities, and therefore each of those schools is run through the formula separately. Comparatively, if you had community under 425, there would not be that category to fund for two schools.
Follow-up?
So if the if there were two schools in and they had a community under 425, then it would be counted as one school?
Through the chair, correct. Rather, it would be counted as one K-6 and one 712.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So on slide 8, we have the criteria for the schools placed into the funding formula for an alternative school. With an ADM of 175 or greater and administered as a separate facility, the ADM is adjusted separately as a separate school. And there are some other criteria. If it's the first year of the school is operating and its ADM is between 120 and 175, then there's an adjustment of 1.33. If the ADM is above 175 but drops below, again, the adjustment is 1.33. And number 3 tells us if the ADM continues to be less than 175, the school is then counted as part of the school in the district with the highest average daily membership. So what that says is above 175, our alternative schools are counted separately. Items 1 and 2 give some flexibility or hold harmless for a lower average daily membership under some conditions for some time. And number 3 tells us if the school continues to be under 175, it's included in the largest school in the district. The second category here is our charter schools. Charter schools with an average daily membership of 150 or greater is adjusted as a separate facility unless the charter school is in the first year of operation and the average daily membership is between 75 to 150, the charter school receives an adjustment of 1.45. Or if the charter school had an average daily membership of 75 or greater in the prior year but has dropped below, again, the charter school receives an adjustment of 1.45. At 75 average daily membership or below, the charter school receives an adjustment of 1.18. So leading in to slide 9, what we're going to do is walk through the foundation formula using the Nome Public Schools as our example. And that's where I pointed that pages 8 and 9 of our other handout also walk through this example. The calculation actually begins on page 8. And if you want to look through and see that calculation in the Excel spreadsheet, you can. So here we have Nome Public Schools, and we have the elementary school at 384 average daily membership. We have the junior senior high school at 252. We have Anvil City Science Academy at 65 and the Nome Youth Facility at 14 ADM for a total ADM of 715. This is one facility in Nome, and so it's going to fall into our category of adjusting the K-6 and then adjusting the 712 and then looking at the Anvil Charter School and looking at the Youth Facility School. So to adjust the K-6, we go to our school size chart that's in statute, and it tells us that for an ADM of 326.10, we need to go to line 6 in that school size chart, because that line is going to fund for schools from 250 to 399. The formula for that funding that you see to the right on line 6 tells us that there's a base for the first 250 students, so the base adjustment increases those 250 ADM to 326.10 AADM. And then for those ADM in that category above 250, we would take the 384 minus 250. Which would leave 134 ADM, and for those 134 ADM, the adjustment is 0.97. We add the base of 326 and our 0.97 adjustment to come up with an adjusted average adjusted daily membership for K-6 of 456.08. So what we've done there is we've started with 384 average daily membership from our October count, and we've increased that to 456. It follows later that the funding will increase, and that's based on school size. Smaller schools have a larger increase than the larger schools. So next we go to the 712, and again, our 712 count was 252, and we go to this through the same process. Because line 6 is 250 to 399, we're in the same place on the ladder for our formula for our junior-senior high school. We take the base of 326, and in this instance, 252 minus 250, we're only 2 ADM over our base, so we multiply that by 0.97, and the outcome is 328.04. So again, we have counted the students in the junior-senior school at 252 in October, but the first thing we're going to do before we go through the rest of the formula is increase the count to 328 to accommodate school size. Next, you'll see the Anvil Charter School at 65 and a funding at 1.18 creates 76.7. And finally, the Youth Facilities ADM of 14. We can see up on line 1 that schools with a count between 10 and 19.99, the base is 39.6. So our small schools, as in this example, 14, those are funded as one school, and the school size starts at 39.6. The total here for the school size adjusted ADM, and that's just the first factor in our formula, is 900.42. And if we look at page 8 and we look across at Nome, we can see that in the column labeled K, we started with 715 ADM, and after we went through that first factor in our formula to increase the ADM for school size, column O has us at 900.42. So we're done with our first calculation, school size. The next item that will...
If I could just interrupt with a question. Adjust school size adjusted ADM. Obviously, we have started with the actual count of students. And there's been a lot of talk over the years. Nobody has actually followed through, but there's been a lot of suggestions that this adjusted ADM ought to be called something different. You know, it ought to be called maybe a school formula factor or something, you know, anything different than ADM because of the confusion, because we're not talking number of students anymore, we're talking an adjusted number of students. And the question I have is roughly, what percentage of the total formula makes up the school size factor adjustment, if you happen to have that ballpark is okay, within 10%? I mean, what have we done to the formula at this point?
Chair Keller, we can see that answer on our handout on page 8, where we started with the ADM and we used NOM as an example for 715 and went to column O to a school size adjusted 900.42. If we look to the bottom of the page statewide, we went from 117,562 to 142,656.
Okay,
so here. That would be the actual and could be estimated as a percentage to show the increase for the school size adjustment by itself.
Yeah, column O is 143,210.
I should have told you column N.
N, okay. And then I just want to note for the record that Representative Culver has joined us in. Both Representative Reinbold and Representative Keller have been involved in what is really our primary task this time of year, and that is budget subcommittee. So thanks for your work on it. And, please proceed. Representative Vasquez has a question here.
I'm going to ask the obvious. Why go through all these calculations? What's the purpose? What's the bottom line?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, the bottom line is for the state of Alaska
students
to have a public school funding formula that distributes funds in a rational and studied manner so that school districts can cover their expenditures and hire teachers and heat their buildings and educate Alaska's children. That's the big picture.
So why not just take the number, quote, going through all this circuitous pattern of adjustment, and do like salaries put in a COLA for the region, a cost of living allowance?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, a person could take on a state, school funding formula from many different directions. This is Alaska's choice. We will, as we go through some more factors, get to a geographic cost factor. What our formula is designed to do is to purchase same available education for students in one area in the state as compared to another area in the state. And that's what those adjustments are leading to, is a small school may need to be adjusted. One teacher can be spread across 10 students versus one teacher being spread across 20 students. Geographic cost factors that we'll see later on, if fuel has a higher cost in some areas than others, that's accommodated in this formula for the goal of providing an education in one community that corresponds to an education in another community.
We have two questions, Representative Reinbold and Representative Culver. Did you have a follow-up for?
Oh, well, no, I appreciate that this is set in statute back in 1998, so this is what you have to work with, but I realize that. So, I mean, basically it's an adjustment for geographic costs and school size.
And through the chair, Representative Vasquez, it's been known as a strong formula. When we have had other occasion to look at it, including the more recent Moore case, this formula was never questioned as far as being an equalized formula. when you look across the United States, there are two types of questions that are posed at state funding formulas. One is the formula equalized? And one is the formula adequate? So yes, it is in our statute. It's what we're working with. It's also well documented and used and has provided Alaska with funding out to our school districts.
Thank you.
Representative Reinbold?
Thank you, Chair Keller. First of all, I want to agree with the name, average daily membership. I mean, membership in what? I think it's just an erroneous name. I also believe that this formula is rife with error. I mean, it doesn't seem to be logical in many accounts. But what I'm going to drill down, I thought we were saving questions till the end, so unfortunately I have to jump back up to slide number 4. I don't know if that's a big deal for you to do. But the first question I had was the projected count. I mean, how is that projected count done?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the projected count takes place at the school district, and that is done by the school district administration, and they look at the students that they have in the classrooms the current year, and then they look at the size of the cohorts coming through. They may use demographic information, and they estimate what their membership would likely be the following year.
Can I continue? Okay, so is there any funding that is done on those projections or not?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, those projections are used to anticipate a deposit to the Public Education Fund for forward funding. However, those projections do not create the actual funding.
Just a follow-up on that for clarification. What would happen if somebody overestimated? What would be the consequences to the district?
Chair Keller, if one district overestimated, their actual would be paid out based on their actual reporting, so there would be really no offset from overestimating.
Okay, follow up?
Okay, in number 5, page 5, the eligibility for state funding. I want to know how many 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, you know, how many we have. If you can get a breakdown for us of how many 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, 22-year-olds, I really would like to know that information, unless you have it off the top of your head. That's one question. And I also would like to know the total enrollment that we have as a state right now.
Thank you. And through the chair, we can look to the total enrollment that the state has right now. Again, we can go to page 8, and we can see in column A our projected enrollment at the very bottom for totals is 117,562.6. And we'll add to that the next column L, which is 10,842.63 correspondence students, for a total enrollment there of average daily membership 128,405.23 across all our districts.
Follow up.
One more, because you jumped back to the report instead of 8 in number slide. So if you're going to go back to the report, which you were just referring to on page 8, I would also like to ask on page 9, in column C, the minimum required local contribution, it says required contribution. Is that required or not? And what's the situation with K, you know, the new lawsuit that's just happened that's saying that you can't require local? And I need to know, I've heard a lot of contradictions. Is it voluntary or or do you require this as a state?
If I could jump in, if it's okay. Sure. If it's okay, I'm going to say let's hold off, because you let her make the get to the section on the local contributions, and then I'll give you an opportunity to re-ask
okay.
the question.
Sounds good.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Reinbold. Representative Culver?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, very briefly. So the formula is pretty complex, and you're the finance director. How many employees does it take, accountants, to figure out each district's and each educational unit, their funding formula allotment? What are we talking staff-wise to just work with the formula and the funding?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, we have one staff member who runs the foundation formula, and then myself provides oversight, and we do have an online system whereby districts report their count by schools. We do use some sorting tools, and so once the district sends that count into the department, it's about 1.5 FTE to administer this program annually.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay. So we are on slide 11, and this is the provision in the formula that provides for hold harmless. And our slide tells us the hold harmless provision was established for districts experiencing a reduction in enrollment. To determine the eligibility, the district sum total of the school size adjustment is compared against the prior fiscal year to determine if a decrease of 5% or greater has occurred. If there is, then the prior fiscal year will become the base. This provision flows over 3 years. The first year, 75% of that school size decrease is added back. The second year, 50% of that school size decrease is added back. And the third year, 25% of that decrease is added back. And then the hold harmless has been instituted, and the district is then funded at their reported school size. For the example that we've been walking through for Nome Public Schools, this slide shows us down below FY14 projected ADM was 702. We went through the school size adjustment and had 884 adjusted school size. For FY15, we started out with 724, went through the school size adjustment, have 900.42 school size adjusted membership. And the difference of 16.18 is an increase. So this school would not be in the hold harmless category. It did not decrease by 5% or more, and in fact it increased in its adjusted school size.
Elizabeth, generally speaking, the public school membership is dropping. So how many of the schools roughly are going through using the hold harmless provision? Do you have any just general statement there on that?
Chair Keller, again, if I could ask you to look at your handout on page 8, when we compare column N to column O, column O is adding any of the districts that entered into hold harmless. So we can see Alaska Gateway. We can see Bristol Bay. We can see Chatham. And I won't read through the entire
sure.
list.
No, that's fine.
Folks can look at that.
Good point.
At another time.
Thanks.
The next item that we've gotten to is our district cost factors. cost factors are specific to each school district. They range from 1.0 to 2.116. And so in increasing through our formula, as we talked about at the very beginning, going from the enrollment in October and increasing that enrollment through the formula for funding, what we're going to do here with this factor is simply multiply our school size adjusted membership of 900.42 by the known cost factor of 1.450. And so we now have our adjusted average daily membership at this point in the formula, 1,305.61.
Elizabeth, on that, is it not true that there's a cost factor study either pending or just finished, or is there a current one going on? I need to be up to date on that.
Chair Keller, there were two studies that came out of House Bill 278, and those were assigned to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, and I'm not quite sure what the timelines are on those.
Thank you.
The next factor that we will use in our calculation is a special needs funding. This includes special education, except intensive will be addressed later. It includes vocational education, gifted and talented, and bilingual, bicultural. And this is a block funding at 20%. And so the formula simply picks up where we were with NOM of 1,305 and increases that by 1.2. So the formula is now at 1,566.73. And what that's doing is it's increasing the average daily membership to provide additional funding to meet the sorts of needs that are mentioned for this factor, the vocational education, gifted, talented, bilingual, bicultural, and special education. So we continue to move through our formula, and slide 16 has us apply another increase for career and technical education. This is a funding factor of 1.015. It's intended to assist districts in providing career and technical education to secondary students. This includes costs excludes specifically costs associated with administrative expenses and instruction in general literacy, mathematics, and job readiness. So when this factor was implemented, it was clear that these funds should be spent on career and technical education for grades 7 through 12.
Is there a means, Elizabeth, of or do you try to track that, or do you just inform the districts of that exclusion? And then, I mean, I would think that it would be counterproductive to be auditing on that issue. So I was just wondering what the follow-up is.
Correct. Chair Keller, we inform the districts of that provision, and we have been very clear to the districts that should they ever be asked, they should be able to provide documentation. But we don't go out and audit on it.
Thank you.
So we are adding the career and technical factor. We're simply multiplying the 1.015 to where we are at with our NOM membership, 1,566.73 times the 1.015 brings us to 1,590.23. The next item that is in our list to calculate funding for our districts is intensive services funding. A school district will receive funding for intensive service students that are receiving the intensive services enrolled on the last day of the 20 school day count period and meet intensive qualifications as is outlined in the department's regulation. The intensive student count is specifically counted for those students that need intensive services. That's multiplied by 13, so it's 1 ADM times 13 is going to create 13 adjusted ADM for intensive students. And our example here in Nome, Nome Public School has 8 intensive students, so we'll have 8 intensive students multiplied by the 13. We'll have 104. We'll add that to our existing adjusted ADM. So 1590 plus the 104 intensive brings us to 1,694.23.
I believe Representative Reinbold has a couple questions on intensive.
Okay, and then you would times that by what number in order to get the total payout for the school?
Each adjusted ADM, it would this year be the base student allocation of 5,830.
And 30. Okay, so I don't know if anyone has time to do a quick calculation of that. Do you know what the Nome Public School is? Right there? Total.
Oh.
5,830 times about $1,700.
Roughly
$600,000. Okay, so I guess I have a question in regards to the intensive needs. I was on the House Education Subcommittee last year. We drilled down on this way harder. And I want to understand the intensive needs. If a student comes and enrolls in a school, and there's 13 times the multiplier of 13 times for that student, how long does that money stay at that school?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the funding goes to the district after the count period is finalized and no further changes are undertaken by the department to adjust funding for the district's annual count. There have been situations where an intensive student has moved out of a district, and those two districts have made an arrangement because one of the districts had the funding and another district had the student.
So it doesn't follow the student for 2 years, an intensive needs student. It's just like every other student. It's just single year. Okay, but then the student can move out, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the money follows the student. It's that school gets it even if the student chooses to leave.
Through the chair, each year it goes to the district that had the student in the count, but the following year the district that then has the student would submit them for count. So each year is a new year.
Is it on that topic, Liz? Because I have a different
question. No, proceed.
Okay, I'm sorry, I have a bad cold, and I missed this slide. So I'm sorry I had to step out when you did slide number 14. But if you could explain to me the gifted and talented, it says they're block funded at 20%. If you could just explain that to me, I apologize that I missed that.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, what this represents is the funding is increased by 20% for the district to use their discretion for the needs of special education, vocational education, gifted and talented, and bilingual, bicultural. What this provides is funding for those categories without having a funding formula that categorically counts students. Some states use a categorical funding count, and they would go and they would have the districts and the schools count each bilingual, bicultural, and then maybe fund those 5%, and then they would go count each of the gifted and talented. What this funding formula does is it recognizes that funds are made available to these groups, and the districts distribute those funds as they need to, but it eliminates the accounting of categorical funding.
Okay, with that, so one, I'd like to know about what percentage of the students, because this is a pretty, I mean, if you look at Alaska numbers, it seems like this could affect a lot of students. So one, the total number or percentage of students that get this, and would this be a true or a false statement? If you have a gifted student in your district, you would get 20% of, is it the BSA additional in a block grant? I mean, how can you, what's the 20%? Is it 20% of what?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold.
Sorry, that was a poorly asked question.
The entire district's funding will be increased by 20%. And so far as the students that participate in that count, the funding formula aggregates funds for districts, but it is discretionary once it gets to the district.
If I could just ask the question a different way, because I think I understand, is the a district may have no gifted program at all, and they would still get the 20%. This is a block that goes through and leaves the discretion and trusts the district to address the areas of the block grant, as I understand it.
Okay. And can I follow up? Do you mind? Okay. So what my true and false question was that got put in there is if you have a gifted student, they get 20% extra for that student. Is that correct?
Through the chair, no, that would not be a correct statement. The district's funding district-wide would be increased by 20%. Mm-hmm. That would provide additional funds at the district, so the gifted and talented students would have some resources out of all of that funding, including that 20%, to put towards those sorts of programs. A portion of that 20% may also be used for the bilingual, bicultural. So the 20% covers multiple needs, not only gifted and talented.
Okay. So I was just using one of the examples. So if you are, you know, a vocational, gifted, talented, bilingual, bicultural, the district, not the school, is that what you're saying, gets 20% extra money? Is that correct?
Through the chair, correct.
And what percentage of students is that total, district-wide?
Through the chair, number? Representative Reinbold, I don't have that. I don't have that.
Estimate?
I don't have the estimate because it is a block grant and the funding does go to the district.
Just a follow-up on that, it kind of goes back to my other one. I would assume there's no audit that follows this either because it is a block grant. So there's no way that we have to know the answer to that question based on the laws the way they're written, because there's no audit required or anything of the districts. I would assume that if a district got audited, it would be in their best interest to be able to demonstrate where 20% went to at least one of those items. But and Representative Reinbold wanted me to ask you how much the block grant is, so it'd be we can look at maybe page 8 and show that.
Thank you, Chair Keller. And again, going to page 8 in column, going from column Q to column R. When we increase from 171,756 to 206,108, that increase multiplied by the current base student allocation would be the dollars attributed to that factor in the formula. I would want to make very clear that this formula is not a categorical formula, and the formula as written is not looked at from one piece to the next, and funds are not directed at any particular student. The funds are generated for the school district, and education, a free public education, is afforded to every student in Alaska, regardless of what sorts of categories that student may or may not align with. And as a student who perhaps is funding in one year in earlier grades took less resources than a student's funding in high school, there's no alignment that particular money sticks with a student. These are resources that are provided to our school districts to fund education in our communities.
Representative Vasquez, please.
Okay. How is intensive student defined? Is that a student with an individualized education plan, or is that a different category of student?
Through the chair, it is a different category of students. It is, I can briefly explain it, and then we would want to go into greater detail at some other time and provide more information for you. The criteria starts by being outlined in regulation at the department, and there are approximately 8 elements in that criteria that demonstrate higher needs and higher cost needs for intensive students. And so there would be an IEP to start with, and that would then be reviewed at the district level, and the district would report back to the department that this was an intensive student based on the criteria in regulation.
So is the answer is, I'm a little confused, is the answer that students with IEP are intensive needs students?
Through the chair, an intensive needs student would have an IEP plus additional information that demonstrated that the student was intensive.
If you would, Elizabeth, you can get those 8 criteria and I can distribute to the committee.
So you could have a student with the IEP, individualized education plan, but not be considered intensive needs student?
Through the chair, thank you. Correct. Yes, Representative Vasquez, you're absolutely correct.
Okay. Representative Culver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly.
Are you done? I didn't mean to. If there was another.
No. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go.
Thank you,
Representative Culver.
How many auditors does the department have with special needs funding? I remember millions of dollars being withheld from the Mat-Su School District over audit after the formula was submitted. I do understand that it is the practice of the department to send out field auditors to audit intensive needs enrollment and then to determine whether or not that student meets the standards or qualifications as interpolated by the department for intensive needs. And I do know it has caused us to have quite a back office to respond to that. We have one whole office that deals with lawsuits over intensive needs and then these kind of funding things. How does that work? Are these department employees? Do we audit every department? What's the compliance? Because it seemed like we had a rocky time there and millions of dollars were threatened to be withheld from the district at that point, and maybe you can go from there to now and...
Before they respond, Representative Culver, I just wanted to say, for the good of the committee, just a reminder, we have a committee bill member in, and it's going to address this, you know, in depth, and I'm not saying that he shouldn't respond. I want him to respond to your question, and you can have a follow-up. But I just wanted to flag that, you know, now is not the time to discuss the particulars of the bill, but essentially what's happened is that the intensive need funding is going to districts, and because of the level of need of these students, they end up, some of them, in private residential, real intensive situations. And there's been some questions about how the money flows through the district to these private institutions. So that is the essence of the bill that we have dropped in that we're going to drill down on later. So it kind of relates to your question.
Right.
So that's why I wanted to throw it out. If we stop, it's not because we're avoiding it.
Okay. And that has to do with intensive, super intensive needs and other issues that students are in a private setting, relative. I'm talking about the school district auditing and compliance and issues there.
Thanks.
For the record, Les Morris, I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Education Early Development. Through the chair, Representative Culver. There was in the past what we'd probably consider a rocky time in terms of legally determining how these that these students are intensive. I would say that has smoothed out in the last actually several years, probably four or five even. Not to say that we don't have disagreements. Let me just clarify a couple things. And the reason why I was asked to come up is it's actually another division where the work of figuring out do these students meet the category of intensive, where that occurs. And it occurs within our teaching and learning support division by folks who have a background in special education. And we no longer actually send people out and monitor for the purposes of determining qualification for these dollars. What we did a few years ago is try to really build some very clear regulations, which is the criteria that we will provide the committee, as the chair requested, that help districts really know here are the qualifications a student needs to meet to be considered intensive, and that information needs to be in the IEP. It needs to be outlined in the IEP. So to become an intensive student, that information is submitted to the department. People with a background in special education, for the period of time that's being reviewed, which is probably about three of our special education staff work on that pretty intensively for a month, and a couple of them might work a little longer on any that would go to appeal. And then if there are pieces that go into hearings or something after that, there's going to be people still continuing to work on that. So it's not full-time staff or contractors doing this. This is part of our special ed team that does other things with special education. Their primary role is, if the district says the student is intensive, to determine do they meet that criteria. And if all the criteria is met, then they are forwarded to school finance as a student who indeed qualifies for intensive funding. There are cases where a student may not qualify from our perspective. We then go back to the district and say, are we missing something because they don't meet criteria three, let's say. I don't know what three is, but the district has an opportunity to submit information, and then we once again look at that, and then we may make a determination that we don't see they qualify. For a couple of years now, we haven't received any, we haven't had any of those go to hearing, which is that's what occurs when they disagree. A couple years ago we did, and we haven't had anything in court for at least 4 or 5 years, something along those lines around this. So I think the process has become clear for qualifying, clear for districts, I think, for qualifying.
All right, thank you for clarifying that.
Okay. Please proceed, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Les.
Okay, so we are on slide 20, and on our step six, which is the last step in adding factors to our foundation calculation here. And step six is correspondence programs. Districts offering correspondence programs receive funding based on 90% of the correspondence ADM. So correspondence ADM multiplied by 0.90 is the level of correspondence funding. And we can see in our NOM example, there are 9 correspondence students. Those are multiplied by 0.90 for 8.10 adjusted average daily membership. We add that to our running total, 1,694.23. We're going to add 8.10 to put our correspondence students into the count to derive 1,702.33. So we now have the final adjusted average daily membership. We started with the count in October. We adjusted the count for 6 calculations in the public education formula, and the next step is to then multiply that adjusted average daily membership by the base student allocation. And that's the calculation we have in front of us on slide 22. That generates $9,924,584 in basic need for the Nome School District. Slide 23 is simply a recap.
Before you proceed, I just want to go back to the correspondence program. Something that confused me for a while. Back on page 20, and maybe I'm still confused, but I don't think so. But this is at a point in the formula that the ADM, or the students, I should say, that are participating in correspondence programs, those other factors, none of those other factors apply. What we're doing is we're just putting in 0.9 of the base student allocation for the correspondence programs. And I think there's confusion on that issue. I think a lot of people think that the correspondence programs get a bigger piece than they get, or I don't know if they do or not, but the point is that this is a separate ADM. This is not the adjusted ADM when it comes to correspondence. Representative Reinbold?
And at that point, Mr. Chairman, what I wanted to know is that why at a 0.9% level? It seems like if you're a correspondence course, it should cost much less than that. So if you could explain why at 0.9, that would be appreciated.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the comment by the chair clarifies a portion of that. The correspondence average daily membership is not run through any of the other increases in the formula. Prior to House Bill 278, which amended the correspondence from 0.80 to 0.90, we were operating with 0.80. The legislature last year, in their review and in their bill, increased that to 0.90. I would have to go back and look at the committee notes to see what discussion happened around that and what the legislature put forth in increasing that from 0.80 to 0.90.
Okay, thank you. So can you tell me how much a correspondence course roughly? I mean, are you telling us that each correspondence is $5,247 each student? Where does that money go?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, that money goes to the school district, and the school district then runs their correspondence programs in a variety of ways. Some school districts may have an outlying community with just a couple students, and there are a couple students who are reporting into a teacher and have a correspondence relationship. Other correspondence programs are larger, such as one of our statewide correspondence programs, and in those situations, the funding goes to the correspondence programs, and along with all the other funding in the district makes choices about how to spend those dollars.
Okay, so you were on slide 23. Oh, and I don't think I ever acknowledged on the record that Representative Drummond joined us, and it was early on. It was only a couple minutes after we started, and I'm sorry that I didn't.
I was part of the roll call.
Were you? Okay, I missed that. Okay.
My butt made it.
I saw you come in late. It just dawned on me. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So we were on slide 23, and this recaps the discussion that we've had walking through the formula. I'm not going to read through each number and decimal. I'll just point out a couple items. At the top of the page, the average daily membership for Nome was 724. And you can see the third number up at the bottom of the page. After going through the formula and adjusting for the formula factors, the adjusted average daily membership is 1,702. And then as we pointed out in the prior slide, the basic need, the funding for the Nome School District is represented there at $9.9 million. Having calculated the basic need, the funding that will be distributed to the Nome School District, the next portion of the formula is to say, how is basic need funded? Because every district will receive their basic need. There are three components. One is required local contribution. The second is federal impact aid. And third is state aid. In order to calculate local contribution, the current year full and true value as provided by the state assessor is multiplied by 2.65 mils. And here we see for our Nome calculation, a little more detail. The lesser of the equivalent of 2.65 mils of the full and true value, but not to exceed 45% of basic need. So for Nome, it's taking the 2.65, multiplying that by the assessor's value to come up with 1,004,049. Because it says not to exceed 45% of basic need, we have a second calculation there that checks to see if that exceeds 45% of basic need, and it does not. We do have three school districts that do contribute based on 45% of basic need rather than the 2.65 tax base, and those are North Slope, Skagway, and Valdez.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Culver.
Just to clarify for the record, the minimum contribution of 2.65 mils would only come into play in organized areas, boroughs, cities, towns that have a school district, correct?
Through the chair, correct.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. I'm going to go back to the question I asked at the beginning. First, Ms. Noodleman, can you tell us, is this required or is this voluntary?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the statute and law requires the local effort.
Okay, so how do you withhold funding? How do you treat a district? Let's say a district decides that they can't come up with that required. What is your policy in regards to that?
Through the chair, the statute directs the department on that issue, and in order to receive state aid for foundation funding, the required local contribution must be contributed.
Follow up
one more time. And with that, knowing what's going on with the Ketchikan court ruling, what is the district's plan? Let's say that there's no more required local funding. What is your plan?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I would just say two things. One is the court case asks if the required local contribution is a designated tax. And I guess the second thing is, with that being an active court case, I would defer.
Did you follow up and then...
Defer to what?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton, did you have on that point?
On that point, Mr. Chairman, I think that, you know, we have to realize that court is challenging our statutes that the legislature passed. And so if that holds, then I think it'll be up to the legislature to address the policy question of how we deal with that in our statutes.
Agreed.
Representative Vasquez?
Mr. Chair, that's not necessarily a question for you, but I would like to see hear an update from AG or someone that's involved in that litigation. I think this committee should be well informed about the status of that litigation. We know that litigation is in progress, but there are attorneys dealing with it and can provide us. You would not be able to do that, but I would...
We will do that. I think Representative Seaton requested the same thing, and we just kind of have been hesitating a little bit to see if there's any changes in the status, but we will... Janet took note of that we'll get the Department of Law down here someday with full understanding that at this point they're going to be as cautious, well, not quite as cautious, or maybe a little less cautious because they know the parameters, but it'll be the same cautionary responses it will get because it is in court.
But certainly for the record, they could explain exactly what's being litigated and what the status is. There shouldn't be no controversy with regard to those facts. Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I just want to say a point really well taken, and it fits with what Representative Seaton just said, is that ultimately this falls back on our shoulders. It's the plan to respond. So go ahead, Representative Vasquez.
How is the minimum required local effort determined?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, the state assessor calculates the assessed value of property in the boundaries of each district and forwards that to the Department of Education, and that's multiplied by 2.65% to equate to a 2.65 mill rate.
Okay. And for the record, I see that there are quite a few districts with a zero minimum required local effort. And why is that? They obviously have land.
And through the chair, Representative Vasquez, those are in unorganized areas of the state. And in accordance with the calculation and statute, there is not a calculation.
Which is a great segue to the next slide, but did you follow up?
No.
Okay.
Okay, that brings us to slide 27, federal impact aid payments. Title VIII federal impact aid payments received from March through the last day of February are used for calculations of state aid. Our example with Nome, the impact aid payments received by Nome total $71,946 for the amount of eligible deduction that the state can look at. And a week ago, we looked through the impact aid program and we walked through the receipts that went to the district and what was eligible for the state to look at from those receipts and use to fund basic need in place of state aid. The calculation here is required local contribution divided by budgeted local contribution to come up with an impact aid percentage. For Nome Public Schools, that's required is $1,004,049 over the $2,103,120 to derive an impact aid percentage of 47.74.
Chair. Representative Seaton.
Can you explain the budgeted local a little more of what budgeted local means?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Seaton. I believe the department is using FY15 projected numbers for this PowerPoint because they were the most recent numbers that we have. That actual calculation will, instead of budgeted, when everything is finalized, that line will say actual local. And the actual local will be the final local contribution from the municipality. It will include the required local from the formula and any additional local that was contributed. So the final calculation will be what was required over the actual final local, and the percentage there, the 47.74, will be the portion of the impact aid that is offset and used in the formula for basic need. And as you can see, the larger the local effort, the smaller that percentage will become, and the less impact aid will be offset and used in the formula rather than left in the district.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Again, after calculating the eligible impact aid, we can see our calculation towards the bottom of the page, $71,946 multiplied by our impact aid percentage, 47.74, and then the last element is to take 90% of that. So an additional 10% is left in the districts, and 90% of our calculation is offset. That's $30,902 for this NOME example. And so here on slide 32, we see the basic need that we calculated, $9,924,584. And the funding of that basic need comes from the required local effort. It comes from the NOME municipality, $1,004,049. Impact aid, a portion of the impact aid is used to fund basic need, $30,912. And then the remaining funding comes from state aid. And the state aid over 12 monthly payments. So that $8,889 would be sent out proportionately, one payment a month to the school district. There are two other items in our formula, the additional local contribution and the quality schools grant. The additional local contribution is calculated as 2 mils of the tax base, or not to exceed 23% of the district's current year basic need. And so in this example for NOME, 2 mils is $7,057,773. And then we do a calculation to compare that, and 23% of basic need is $2,356,492. So it's the larger. NOME could contribute up to an additional $2,356,492. And lastly, the Quality Schools Grant takes the adjusted average daily membership and multiplies that by $16. Here in NOME, we see that's 27,000 237. And that is added to the state aid to come up with this total state entitlement. Finally, our funding does have statutory rule that if the appropriation does not meet all needs, districts will be reduced pro rata. And that's the end of our presentation, and I'm happy to take questions.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Chair Keller. First of all, I'd like to go back in regards to the one of the very first things that we were talking about is the it's on this slide. Okay, it's page 8, and we talked about it's slide 14. It says include special needs education except intensive needs, vocational education, gifted, bilingual are all block funded at 20%. Okay, so that's the two things that I want to discuss. So you said the factor was the 1.20 factor, is that correct?
Through the chair, correct.
So Q, you said the difference between Q and R.
Correct.
So I believe that's about $34 million, is that correct, the block grant?
Through the chair, if your math is correct.
Yep. Public math is always tough to do, and that's why I'm verifying it. I would assume that was something that you all would be looking at carefully. How is that block grant distributed? Is it monthly? Is it yearly? How is it distributed?
Through the chair, that funding is distributed to the school district. It's a component of the basic need here of the $9,924,584. So it's commingled with all of the other funds in the foundation formula, and districts receive a payment 1/12 of their state aid each month.
Can I follow, please?
Follow.
Okay, so this, like, let's say a student can be, let's say they go to one school, the gifted students and the bilingual, et cetera, there, but it goes to the district, so it doesn't necessarily follow the student. This follows the district. Is that correct?
Through the chair, correct.
Okay, and if you have any more information in regards to that and the percentage of students, because $34 million is a considerable chunk of money, and I would just like to know as much information in regards to that grant and how that money is distributed across the state. If you could get that for me, I would really appreciate it. And second, I'd like to talk to you about preschool. The three, you said if they have an IEP, they can enter school at age 3. Can anybody else, or do you have to have an IEP to enter preschool? I know that Anchorage School District, I believe, added 3 new school districts for a total of, preschools for a total of 14 in the Anchorage School District. I don't know how many preschools that we have, and are we funding those preschools with state dollars?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the purview of the state funding formula is just those students who are 3 years old and have an IEP and are receiving those specialized services are funded through the public education formula.
Can I follow up, please?
Follow.
So every single preschool student has an IEP that's in any of our public education. Is that correct?
Through the chair, I wouldn't believe so. What the public education funding formula covers is providing funding. So if there is another situation with a 3-year-old with preschool that does not fall under an IEP and is not funded by the public education formula, that would be outside of this discussion.
Okay. Okay, so like I stated at one of the first questions, I'd like to know how many three-year-olds, how many four-year-olds, how many five-year-olds, all the way up to 22. You know, the 5 through 18 is all right, but if you can get, you know, the 19, 20, 21, and 22, and then the 3, where they're distributed and how much we're spending on preschool in public education with state dollars right now.
Through the chair, I'll take that question back to the department and we'll work on that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 31, where we're talking about the impact aid and that contribution, I'm just curious as to how impact aid flows, and does that flow to the individual borough, or does that flow to the state and subtract it out? How does what's the flow of impact aid?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, impact aid flows from the federal impact aid program directly to the school districts. When we talk about federal programs, the phrase that you would hear around that type of program is federal direct. It doesn't go through the state. It goes from the federal level to the school districts. The school districts apply on their own behalf. They collect the money on their behalf from the federal level. The only difference to that is our military bases, and that check comes to the state of Alaska and we turn around and forward the entire amount to those school districts.
Okay, so a follow-up. So the 47%, that's a basically a calculation then it is, or the time 90%. So that's reducing the amount of state aid, and the rest of the money is with the school district. Is that stays with the school district?
Through the chair, correct.
Okay. Representative Seaton?
On another topic, on slide 37, on this quality school grants, I can't remember what the calculation or what the consideration was for establishing quality school grants and whether they were directed at any particular thing like continuing education or I mean career technical or I said, can you just remind me what that the quality school grants, what the basis were of those were?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Seaton. The quality school grants are for intervention strategies for students who are not meeting education achievement, and especially in the core areas of reading, writing, and mathematics. Examples of the use of the quality schools grants could be things such as summer school or after school tutoring. And I could provide further information if that is needed.
Mr. Chairman, follow-up. Thank you. I was having a blank remembering what quality school grants were. I mean, I understand that it's a certain amount, but I was just wanting to make sure that we all understood what that part of the formula was put in for, and I had forgotten, so thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Culver.
Although this might be not in order, but it would be helpful for those of us that just landed here, but I guess it would be your call whether or not it's germane to this, but last year there was an Omnibus Education Act that put in statute bumps in the BSA, and then there was one-time money. Would it be appropriate to kind of explain to us what the components of funding were in that legislation as far as the one-time money and what direction that was headed for, and these, those statutory changes to the BSA?
I'm completely open to asking the question, but I doubt if they came prepared for that. But if you like, we could, you know, get the follow-up information. We'll see what they have to say.
Les might have that on top of it. I guess the question through the chair would be to the department. What are the highlights, if you will, of the legislation passed at the end of the session last year that codified the BSA increases and then the one-time monies? Just a broad brush overview. Don't expect all the details. Just to familiarize those of us, because there's a lot of things being tossed around. We're not funding one time. The money's built into statute. It's already decided.
Through the chair, Representative Culver, I can speak to that broad brush for the funding formula. There were multiple elements in HB 278, and so I will be leaving out some of those, and it's not for any reason except for that I'm just going to talk about the dollars that really affected the public education funds. What HB 278 did was it provided a three-year plan, shall I say, around the public funding formula. And in 2015, it set the BSA, the base student allocation, at $5,830. At 2016, and in doing so, that was a $150 increase for 15. In 16, there was an additional $50 increase to bring the BSA, the base student allocation, to $5,880. And in 2017, there was another $50 increase in the base student allocation to bring that to $5,930. And those increases are currently in law and currently in the entitlements for FY15, and the foundation funding increase for the base student allocation is currently in the governor's FY16 budget. Along with that, there was one-time funding provided, again, over 3 years. It was distributed in the same manner as the foundation formula distributes funding. And in 2015, the first year, it was $42.9 million. In 2016, the second year, it was $32.2 million. And in 2017, the third year, it was $12.4 million. The current FY16 budget, the governor's budget, does not have the $32.2 million one-time money included. The other changes to the formula from HB 278 were increasing correspondence from 0.80 to 0.90 was an increase of approximately $6 million a year towards foundation. There was some increases that provided higher funding for charter schools at a lower count, and that is around $500,000 annually, and that remains in law. So that's a snapshot of how HB 278 affected public school funding.
Representative Culver? Well,
thank you. Very helpful. Quick follow-up. Can you reiterate the one-time funding amount in the governor's budget related to what the law had stated or the intent of that statute? You said 16, didn't you?
We took out.
For the record, again, Les Morris, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Education, Early Development, through the chair, Representative Culver. The The amount in for one time for FY16 was $32 million.
Right.
And that, in the governor's budget, was not included.
Okay.
And there is some conversation about the FY17 as well, not being included.
Okay, thank you. That clarifies that, Mr. Chairman.
But another, just a broader question, and I want to call attention to it anyway, and maybe while you're here, maybe you have a comment. But if you go to the Department of Education website and look down in the far right-hand corner, you'll see a tab or a link to school finance. And under that link of school finance, you find annual revenue. And if you click on that, you'll get a spreadsheet that shows all the revenue sources, you know, and it's divided up by district, and it's actually calculated per pupil in the state of Alaska on the average. But anyway, there's columns in there, other and special. You got state, local. We've been talking about those today, in in federal, and then you've got other and special. If you would, just give us a little bit of a description, if you can, right off the top. I meant to get a copy of this to the committee, just as a reminder that it's there. And I find it a very useful spreadsheet, and it is, you know, made for a quick reference. And we can distribute that, Janet, if we can, to the committee members. It's easy to link into. But anyway, just define, I know it's on the bottom of the page, but just talk to us a little bit about what other and special is.
Thank you, Chair Keller. On the spreadsheet that is available on the department's website, the category other is earnings on investments, the E-rate program, and some very small other contributions from communities, such as scholarship funds. The special revenue category on that all revenues spreadsheet is predominantly the federal programs, grant entitlement funds, such as our IDEA special education funding and our Title I funding. So that spreadsheet does break out those categories of funding.
Okay. What prompted the question was actually Representative Seaton's question, and I was wondering, there's nothing that I can glean from this spreadsheet. Maybe you can help me on impact aid, right? I mean, it would be just included in the column under federal.
Chair Keller, you're correct. Impact aid would be included in the column under federal, and a large part of that is impact aid, because the other federal grants are in special revenue.
Would it be difficult for you, Elizabeth, you work with these things all the time, to break down that federal column into two or three columns or more? Make one column impact aid, another column Title I-A, another one Title, you know, whatever, all the federal funds, so we can, in a spreadsheet type thing. I know you gave us this information in the side-by-side chart here some time ago, but it might be interesting. Is that difficult or is that hard?
Chair Keller, I don't have a breakdown of the federal programs by type that would be, resource effective to break out. I believe I'll go back and look. I do believe our impact aid presentation has the total impact aid on it. So that could be broken out from the federal column. What you'll find is, for example, I have the 13 sheet in front of me because it takes a while to aggregate data. Of the $137 million in federal funding in the operating fund for FY13, approximately 97% of that is impact aid.
Oh.
So I could clarify the note on that page and let people know that that's predominantly impact aid.
That'd be wonderful. Great. Super. Representative Reinbold, question, did you?
Thank you. I'm not on the subcommittee for education this year, so I'm going to ask you just at a high level to say the number, the total number of federal dollars I believe it's a $1.6 billion budget. First, your total budget, either the percentage or the number of federal dollars, the state, the local contributions. I know you have that. You had it in a beautiful little pie chart, so don't have it in front of me. You had it last year.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I think we could provide the eight-page document that actually outlines that as the best approach. I'd rather not make estimates and be off on the record with the estimates.
Well, can you just, I know you know this pretty darn inside and out right now, just roughly the percentages of the state contribution, the local contribution, and the federal, or if you just want to speak to the state dollars and the federal dollars?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, we have an eight-page document. It's prepared. It's published. We will send that up so you could have it pretty quickly when we respond to the questions from the committee. And I really, I know those things, but I can't speak without having the information in front of me and put an accurate number on the record, and I really want to make sure I'm accurate.
Okay. Great. Look forward to that, and we'll make sure it gets distributed. Any other last questions for the Representative Seaton?
This would be off the topic.
That's fine. Work.
Okay. Yeah. The other day, we were having a discussion on, you know, student achievement and testing.
Oh, you mean it's not on the formula?
That's right.
Okay, well, thank you. We'll continue, but we'll put other business for the committee. But thank you so much. It was a good, helpful presentation. If there's no further questions.
But I'm going to have...
Oh, I see.
Oh, well, okay.
It's off the topic, but he wants you in a frying pan. Thank you, Elizabeth. So.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of this revolves around changes we made in 278 last year. In the past, we had required that work keys be taken by all kids in 11th grade and had provisions that they could then work to improve their scores on that because it was going on their transcript and would be available to employers who request transcripts. And that was also as an incentive for students to improve, to know where they were and improve their employability. And last year in 278, we took and said, after much discussion, that students could choose whether they would take work keys or SAT or ACT. We did not remove the requirement that the work keys be on the transcript for employers to have access to. And I requested information after that, and I'm finding that the department has determined that they are not going to record the best scores of students on work keys, so that as our students prepare for the workforce, whatever they take in the 11th grade is going to be the required score. And even though they pay for the test administered in the school, beyond that, those scores won't be up. So we have, to my way of thinking, what we are doing is limiting the ability of students to improve their personality on their transcript or their resume for employers. And I just can't understand why we would be taking something by regulation out that we required to be put there specifically so that students would achieve and strive further to improve their resume. And my understanding, I'm not quite sure whether we are also, if a student chooses SAT or ACT as their test, whether those scores are going on the transcript is not the required test, but as the test that they're choosing to take. But I think that, you know, we as a committee need to look at, you know, how we are going to have students engaged in improving their skills and their resumes and employability, and whether we are removing those tools from students. And so, since I had the response, I wanted to get the...
Could I get a clarification before you respond? You're not suggesting, right, that the information is not available. The question is whether or not it's on the transcript. In other words, every student has available their test results, as I understand it. But I just want to know what you're, you know, if you're asking specifically about that thing. I just wanted to make sure.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The reason is because we wanted to have employers to have a basis of being able to retrieve from the school system the information that, yes, this student has achieved a certain level on work needs, and they could compare students across the state if they were hiring from one graduate here and one graduate there. What does a diploma mean?
Right.
You know, because that's part of what we were doing. And so we were allowing those students to improve, and the best score would be on the transcript.
Yeah. Thanks for the clarification. Les?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. So the prior to this year, actually, because the law passed last session, I just will reiterate what Representative Seaton said. There was a requirement in state regulation that the board put in place, that the state board is the board I'm referring to, put in place, that a student who took the work used that score was to be on that student's transcript, and that the student had the opportunity to retake that exam in their 12th grade year, and the way the requirement was is that the better of the scores was what would go on the transcript. After HB 278 was passed last year, it changed from requiring all students to take work keys, and it said that all students would either take one of three tests: work keys, ACT, or SAT. Because a work key score would no longer be available for many of the students, that regulatory requirement that work keys be on the transcript was in fact removed by the State Board of Education, because in many cases it would be a requirement that we put something there that wouldn't exist. Mm-hmm. What remains in regulation is a requirement that the cumulative record, and generally a cumulative record at the high school level, is the transcript. That the cumulative record contain the scores of the students. However, I would believe that Representative Seaton is accurate in saying that you might not have the best score, because what's going to arrive in there most likely now is the student takes the assessment in their junior year that was prescribed last year, one of those three assessments, and only do they take it in their senior year. Well, let me step back. They take it in their junior year and the state pays for it. In their senior year, they may take it. The state only pays for it if they did not take it in their junior year. So their cumulative record of state assessments has to include the one that was taken based on the state requirement. However, the best score, in fact, might not be in the cumulative record, even though the student would have it, based on the current regulatory requirements.
Quick question.
Just
a follow-up first?
Yeah. Just a quick follow-up. I think that the committee and the legislature needs to really look at how do we engage students and how do we keep them working. If we say that, well, okay, your scores from 11th grade are there, and that's it, and there's no need to study, to work hard, to do anything more, because that's where you are, and employers are going to get transcripts from students, and that's going to be the comparison of what the score was on the 11th grade. Forget 12th grade, you know, I mean, the whole thing was to try to see if we could get students engaged in learning in their senior year and not slack off, because they have a way to actually demonstrate. So I think that as we go forward, we may need to look at making sure that we are engaging students and improving throughout their school time.
Okay. On that topic, is it, or a different one?
It's ACT, SAT.
Representative Reinbold?
Thank you, Chair Keller. So what my question to you is, I know there was an estimate on House Bill 278 for how much it was going to cost the state for all students to take the work keys, ACT and SAT. If you could get a more solid number for all the students, what the finals costs are in regards to that. And also, what percentage of the students go to post-secondary education and what percentage graduate from post-secondary education? And the third question would be, does the state automatically get those test scores now that the state is paying? So basically, every ACT, SAT, do those scores go directly to the state, or is that confidential information for the student?
Through the chair, we'll be able to provide you the costs because we provided that to the committee last week. I don't have that file with me, so we'll get that information to you. And what we'll provide you is the contract costs for doing the that go to ACT, which does the ACT and work keys, and the contract costs for College Board, which covers the SAT. The post-secondary is not data that I would have. You'd need to work with the university on that, or Alaska Post-Secondary Education may have some information regarding that, but I don't, the department doesn't have that completion information. I think it's available by working with both the Alaska Post-Secondary Education, perhaps, and the university system. And then you had the last question was about the I might need you to repeat. It was about the SAT and ACT in particular, but I don't remember the specific question.
Thank you. Okay, so in regards to this in particular question, I believe I'm going to first of all step back. I think it's around 10% graduating from a post-secondary degree within about 5 years. So I will work with that. I'm now on the Alaska Commission of Post-Secondary Education, so I will be looking into that. But I think the number is about 10% of Alaska students graduating with a four-year degree. But what my final question to you was, is because the state is now paying for the ACT, SAT, or work keys, do the scores automatically come to the state, or are they considered confidential?
Through the chair, Representative Ryan Bold, we do get those scores because those scores are also used for calculating and determining if students are eligible for the Alaska Performance Scholarship. And so the districts get the information. They verify that those students, in fact, qualify based on that information. And then we basically have it to, as a follow-up to audit to make sure that, in fact, is accurate. And that's the only purpose. The only other reason that we use the data for is actually participation rate. The more, if all the students participate in the program, the school gets a higher rating in our accountability system.
Can I do a
follow-up?
Okay, so have we always gotten the ACT, SAT scores? Is this new since the Alaska Performance Scholarship? I believe that was Senate Bill 221 many years ago that started the APS. So one, is it new that the state is getting that information?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the only reason we had a need for it is for the Alaska Performance Scholarship so that we could provide those scholarships to the students. So prior to that, we just received at the state level aggregate data, and I think down to the how the school performed for those students who took the assessment. But we had no need for it prior, so yes, in terms of our getting that data, it's based on need.
Thank you for indulging me. So we've gotten these scores for the ACT, SAT, even before we were paying for them because of Senate Bill 221 or the Alaska Performance Scholarship. Is there any new additional information we get now that the state is picking up the cost?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, there isn't any new information we're getting because of the fact that we pay for the assessments that we did not already receive.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're requiring, we used to require work keys, and now we let the students choose whether they want to take work keys, SAT, or ACT. Required to be on the transcript, does that mean that the original, the first SAT or ACT that the student takes in high school is recorded on the transcript as well as work keys? And so if they then take it again to improve their score, that does not appear on the transcript.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, the requirement is that it be in their cumulative record, generally a transcript at the high school level, any state standardized assessments. And the only time you could consider that a state standardized assessment is when the student is taking it because the state law or regulation compels them to take that. When a student takes the SAT on their own, that I don't believe that I would consider that a state assessment and therefore required to be in their cumulative record. However, that assessment, if that score were better, it certainly is submitted and utilized for the purposes of the Alaska Performance Scholarship, however.
All right. So, Mr. Chairman, again, I guess what I'm trying to do is figure out whether we are in the attempt to get people to continue to work and improve, or whether we are saying you're stuck with your first test score on your transcript forever, and you can have a separate piece of paper on your own and try to convince an employer, but if an employer gets your transcript to find out who they want to hire, you're going to not have your best resume because we have this policy that says that you can't, improvement doesn't count beyond the first required assessment. So I'm concerned about that, and I think that we ought to maybe look at that as far as how we help improve the education quality and continuous improvement kind of idea through high school. And thank you.
And maybe in these questions, the department will review legislative intent and see if there's something that would be done and be very clear whether further legislation is needed in order to try to clean that one up.
Chair Keller, I might add, I just think it's important that an employer would only have that student's transcript if that student gave them that transcript. The school can't give an employer that transcript. Yeah. And while I understand it means multiple pieces of paper, then the student would know that transcript was provided and therefore could provide other things. That record can't be provided to an employer without that student actually saying they want it provided to that employer. I know it is a challenge sometimes to have multiple records, so I understand what Representative Seaton's concern is and don't necessarily disagree with it. I just want to be clear that no one's going to have that record. No employer is going to have that record without that student knowing it.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Seaton, for calling that to our attention. I want to know, we all now have Finance 101. Do we get that on our transcript or whatever? Thanks. We'll adjourn. Oh, first of all, on Friday, bring your HB 30 documents, and that's the only thing I think we have up on Friday. So thank you. We're adjourned at 10:01.